Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, May 2nd, and I'm your host, Cara Santamaria. This week's episode is brought to you by you. Thank you so much for ensuring that Talk Nerdy stays possible week after week and ensuring that it remains 100% free to download for anybody who would like to listen. You support the show in so many ways, rating and reviewing on iTunes and other feed readers and podcast catchers by visiting carasantamaria.com and going to the Talk Nerdy store where we have brand new, super soft, slim cut, cool t-shirts in stock, and also by supporting the show via PayPal or Patreon. Now, through the Patreon portal, I want to thank a handful of you who especially helped make the show possible this week. First, I want to thank Phil T-Bear and Timothy Glover. And I also want to thank Charles Payet, Jafe, the Honorable Husband, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and last but absolutely not least, probably the opposite of least, best. I don't want to say best. There are so many great people here, but thank you so much to Jeffrey Sewell for your continued contributions. All right, guys, I'm really, really excited about this week's episode because I had a chance. If you remember, I think 2 weeks ago, we aired an episode with Neil Shubin, and it was pretty short because I had to go visit him in Irvine where he was doing a colloquium, and he just had a really tight schedule. But what an incredible guy. He wanted to make sure that we were able to do, you know, a full episode and do it justice. So he agreed to chat with me one more time remotely from his home in Chicago, and oh my gosh, we just had so much fun. So I'm really pleased to welcome for a second time today the Robert R. Bensley Professor of Organismal Biology and Anatomy and the Associate Dean for Academic Strategy, the Committee on Evolutionary Biology, and the Committee on Development, Regeneration, and Stem Cell Biology. Oh my gosh, busy guy. Also, you know him as the host and the creative genius behind Your Inner Fish, which was a PBS series that was adapted from a wonderful book that he wrote of the same title. Without any further ado, here he is, Dr. Neil Shubin. Well, Neil, thank you so much for joining me once again on Talk Nerdy. I'm so excited to continue our conversation.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So last time we chatted, and that was as far as listeners are concerned, the episode was 2 weeks ago. We were at the National Academy of Sciences, I guess they have a building in Irvine.
Yeah, it's a conference center called the Beckman Center in the UC Irvine campus. They use it for meetings and so forth.
And it was actually like, it's a really nice conference center. So we were chatting in your temporary office there while you were there to do some, you were there for a Sackler colloquium,
right? I was there for a meeting on gene regulation and evolution. I was co-leading it. It was a lot of fun, you know, a bunch of scientists in for 2 or 3 days to talk science and using that. It's a really swish center. They know how to run a meeting there. It was fabulous.
Nice. So we were lucky enough to be able to go down there. My electric car obviously can't make it that far and back because I don't have the next generation. I'm not a Tesla driver yet. So sweetly, little mini Stella came with, and her father drove us.
So cute. And
I love Stella. So she was sitting there. She had questions, and she actually submitted a few more questions for this conversation. So as it becomes pertinent, I'm going to bring up her questions because they're really good.
Sounds good to me.
Cool. So to pick up where we left off, one thing that I noticed, I was talking to my boyfriend last night a little bit about, you know, he loved Your Inner Fish. And I was like, do you have any questions you would want to ask Neil? Is there anything you can think of that doesn't make sense to you? And one of the questions that he asked right off the bat was very similar to one that Stella asked. Stella asked it pretty eloquently, so I'm going to read it to you, and then maybe we can talk a little bit about the context around it. And that was, let's see. Okay. Is Tiktaalik just one of many land invasions? And if so, do we know anything about other water-to-land species? And kind of on the flip side of that, my boyfriend was asking, you know, if we know that we evolved from Tiktaalik, like we know that we have all of these evolutionary features in common with Tiktaalik, and maybe you can give a little bit of background on who Tiktaalik is, on what Tiktaalik is, for people who didn't listen to two episodes ago. But he was saying, wouldn't there be a bunch of other false starts, or is there any kind of concurrent evolution that happened with a species similar but that wasn't Tiktaalik?
Yes, that's a great question. So just a reminder, Tiktaalik's a fossil. It's about 375 million years old. And it's right at the cusp of the transition from life in water to life on land. And it's, you know, it's the closest cousin of creatures with arms and legs, you know, just like us. And Tiktaalik, you know, was a creature that had both lungs and gills. It had, you know, fins with sort of arm bones and wrist bones inside of it. And it's part of a group of creatures that have those features. These are lobe-finned fish. Tiktaalik is one of several of those. It's distinguished by the fact that it is the closest relative to us because it shares a lot of, you know, unique features with us.
But just to interject, is Tiktaalik considered a tetrapod?
No.
Or is it pre-tetrapod?
It's a pre-tetrapod, yeah. It depends on the definition, really. But, you know, it had fins with fin rays, but inside the fin with fin rays are limb bones. So it's kind of in that area where it depends how you define the term tetrapod. And believe me, people argue about that all the time.
It's kind of like Archaeopteryx where, you know, it is a bird, sure, but it's also a dinosaur.
Yeah, and, you know, but it has a lot of fishy characteristics too, Tiktaalik does. You know, it has scales in its back. It's got a lot of bones like a fish. So, you know, it's really the characteristics that interest me, not necessarily the name. But anyway, so the question's really a good one because, you know, if you look at that interface between water and land, you know, it's kind of the area where Tiktaalik was living, like in the water bottom, in the mud flats, in the shallows, and so forth. You know, there are a lot of critters that live there in the fossil record, and there are a lot of creatures that are there today. I mean, there are perch that can live 24 hours on land and can walk from pool to pool. There are mud skippers that can live in the mud and on land. There are climbing perch that some of them can actually, you know, seen to climb trees. You know, so there are fish that do all kinds of amazing things. And what most people don't realize is all kinds of different types of fish have adaptations to breathe air. Okay. And they usually use those adaptations either to breathe air when the, you know, the oxygen in water, whether it's a pond or a stream, decreases, that gets relatively anoxic, or they use it to live in the mudflats, kind of like the mud skipper or that climbing perch I was telling you about. Now, what's interesting about Tiktaalik is different from these things. So there are a lot of other fish that walk. There are fish that walk on the water bottom, you know, like frogfish and so forth. There are different types of sharks that do that. In fact, even if you look at rays, you know, on the bottom, they'll walk with their little fins. So walking's not unusual in fish at all. Indeed, lungs are present in fish as well, you know, all these things. What makes Tiktaalik different is it's a member of our lineage, and there are a lot of characteristics that show that very clearly, along with some other fish from the Devonian time period, which Tiktaalik's from. What's interesting is we think there was kind of one invasion of land in our branch of the Tree of Life, but there are many other fish that have adaptations to live, you know, on land, you know, partially. Keep in mind that our lineage, our branch of the Tree of Life, is sort of a newcomer to land in the Devonian. I mean, the first, you know, organisms to make the shift from water to land were land plants. We were plants that evolved adaptations to land. We were microbes and so forth. They were followed by the invertebrates. So think of the invasion of land as following their successive waves. You know, first come the plants and their relatives, then come invertebrate creatures, and then come the vertebrates, our branch of the Tree of Life. What's interesting here is that if it wasn't for the plants and if it wasn't for the invertebrates, our, you know, ancestors' invasion of land could never have happened, right? There would have been no food on land. There would have been no ecosystems for them to populate. So really, the whole ecosystem that Tiktaalik and its cousins were moving into back in the Devonian was a new ecosystem. Right? So, you know, this didn't exist 100 million years before. You know, shallow freshwater streams with soils that are stabilized by roots. Why? Because it took plants to do that, to make the habitats in the first place. So really plants and the invertebrates that followed them made the habitats, you know, that allowed our distant relatives to make the transition from life in water to life on land. And it really happened, by the, sort of in the latish Devonian. We can quibble about when, but, about 380, 375 million years ago, you start to see these fish around.
That's fascinating. And it's something that I don't think we often think about. When we talk about evolution, especially individuals who I think are passionate about science and who read a lot about science in the news, but didn't necessarily have the opportunity to commit, hours and hours of personal time to studying science in the laboratory or in the classroom.
Or in a cold tent in the middle of the Arctic.
or that. I think that evolution is kind of this enigma for a lot of people, because it's like we sort of get it, but I think that there are a lot of, we talked about this a little bit on the last episode, and I think it's an important thing to jump into because this prompted the conversation with my boyfriend last night. We often think of evolution in a very linear way. It's how it's been presented to us through popular media and even through historically through some kind of misguided textbooks. And so I thought it would be interesting to talk a little bit about why this branching tree, this prickly bush, actually, as Stella calls it, is such an important way to start rethinking about evolution in the popular consciousness.
Well, think of it this way. I mean, most people think that lungs evolved to enable creatures to live on land. Most people think that feathers evolved to, help birds fly. Mm-hmm. Those things are really obvious. I mean, they're logical. They also happen to be entirely wrong. Okay, if you look at the evolutionary record, the evolutionary trees we have of fish, lungs are primitive. Okay, they appeared in aquatic animals first, and they appeared in aquatic animals that really needed dual-purpose respiration, like lungfish and creatures like that. Living in water and having to gulp air when the level of oxygen in the air. In the water gets decreased, and so mm-hmm. what happened is it's not really that the lungs arose to enable creatures to walk on land. They already existed. They were helping critters like Tiktaalik live in water often, and it was really repurposing or shifting the function of features that already existed. I mean, the same thing is largely true with feathers. I mean, feathers were one of the arguments for the origin of feathers often is that they served as insulation for critters and other factors, not really for flying per se. So what we see is part of this. This non-linearity, which you're talking about with evolution, really comes down to the fact that oftentimes features arise in one context, in one adaptive, regime, but the biggest change is really a shift in function, a change in how they're used. So much of what we see in evolution is repurposing structures and genes and developmental processes that originally evolved in one context and shifting them for new ones. And we see this again and again and again. So when you think of this sort of linear caricature of evolution, of one species leading to another species, leading to another mm-hmm. species, and gradual progress with features evolved at every step along the way to allow that progress to happen, that's not how it works. Okay, it's a crazy branching tree, a tangled bank is what Darwin called it. But even more, it involves features evolving in one context and shifting their function. Repurposing is the best way to put it. And what that means is then these great transitions, which seems so impossible, right? You got to wait for lungs to evolve to live on land. Well, no, all of a sudden they become much more likely because you have fish swimming around in Devonian streams and estuaries with lungs, swimming around with arm bones inside their limbs. So, when land became an adaptive zone of that was high quality, then those features were already there. So it doesn't mean evolution doesn't have to wait for new features at every step, right? It repurposes, and so that's a big piece of this, And we see that again and again and again. It's not just the shift from life in water to life on land. It's origin of birds. It's origin of bodies. It's you name it. We can we can talk forever about that.
Yeah, and the idea that it's not guided, that this is something that when we talk about nature, kind of. Forming or nature sort of informing the way that these organisms will thrive. This isn't a decision that was made. It wasn't a pick and choose situation. It's a really random process. These are just random mutations, random occurrences. And the globe happened to be in such a situation where some organisms happened to do well and others happened to kind of you know, shit the bed and not be able to make it.
Right. So, you know, so evolution's random in a lot of ways. It's non-random in others. You know, so the kinds of mutations that appear, they're not random. I mean, there's some are more likely than others, you know, and based on how the genome's structured, based on how we develop, you know, certain types of mutations are going to be more common than others. And some are going to be more viable in organisms than others. The way evolution's totally random, it's random with regard to the future needs of an organism. You know, so just because a fish may need in 5 million years, its descendants may need to live on land, I mean, its mutations aren't going to predict the future. And I think that's a big deal, because what that means is evolution's not a goal-directed process. That is, you can have non-random mutations based on the biology of an organism, right? You know, if you and I were submitted to, you know, UV radiation, X-rays and so forth, you know, our genes will mutate, right? And they'll mutate in certain ways that we could probably predict.
Yeah, I might get certain types of tumors.
Yeah, exactly.
I might have certain kinds of features, but I'm probably not going to sprout wings and fly.
There you go. And it's not going to be like predicting, well, you know, in 500,000 years, this is what you're going to need kind of thing. So, you know, so biology makes certain mutations non-random, but, you know, evolution doesn't predict the future. And that's huge, because it means that evolution's not a goal-directed process.
And also it means that there are a lot of false starts that we forget about, right? Lots of times when we look at the fossil record, I think because as human beings, we have this very, what is my lineage perspective? We're very interested in that. I mean, I think that that's why My Inner Fish does resonate so much. I think that's why Tiktaalik resonates so much, is that really understanding basically my own personal family tree going back hundreds of millions of years is so meaningful to me. And it's so meaningful in so many ways, whether it's just personal curiosity or applications in medicine and in understanding our own genetics. That said, there are tons of fossils out there that never became anybody, that never evolved to be anything. They were just, you know, kind of bad missteps. They didn't do well. They found themselves to be irrelevant.
Well, there are more of them than the others, right? So, I mean, and in fact, they're, you know, look at a museum, walk through the halls. It's the non-avian dinosaurs, right? You know, it's it's the mammal-like, the quote, mammal-like reptiles, which are really, you know, cousins of mammals. It's a lot of, you know, a lot of evolutionary dead ends out there, you know, of cousins who just didn't make it. But they're loaded with biology. And by the way, they made it for long periods of time. So we're only, you know, we're looking back and we're defining everything in our terms. That's what Inner Fish was about, actually. But if we, you know, if sort of take the global view, and you say, you know, if you define success by, you know, how many millions of years did a group of organisms live on Earth, and how many environments did it populate, and how many individuals did it have, and how many descendants did it leave over a period of time, there, you know, there are a lot of successful groups. We'd probably call them dead ends because they didn't leave to us.
right. I know. Again, well, even in the question, it's so like personally bound. And it's true. We've only been around for what, 200,000 years?
Yeah, we're kind of nothing. Yeah, exactly.
We're barely here.
We're just full attitude is what we are. Yeah.
We so are. I love that. So here's a bit of a complicated question from Little Stella that I actually, so sorry, Stella, I keep calling you Little Stella. You just really impress me. Here's a complicated question from Stella that I think is going to be quite interesting to a lot of listeners, but maybe would require a little bit of extra explanation. So she says, one of my favorite hypotheses is RNA world hypothesis, that life started out with genetic material encoded in RNA instead of DNA, as it's another gap filled in on the tree, or rather very scraggly bush of evolution. What's your take on it? And do you think it would be wise to look at early archaean bacteria for transitional species between RNA and DNA?
Well, people do look at those all the time. I mean, what we're finding is that the, you know, the biggest and richest branches of the tree of life are the ones at the base of the tree of life. You know, we're just one little twig. But there was a recent tree of life published about 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, something like that.
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, shows if you look at the microbial world, I mean, it's a rich diversity out there. And there are many different ways for critters to make a living. And that's not even including viruses, right? There are just so many genetic ways for creatures to metabolize, to move about, to reproduce. You know, so every time you think that, you know, you kind of get it, that biology does something in one way, no, there's exceptions to everything. And in fact, there's just great diversity to almost every aspect of life. And what that means is then, you know, what, why the RNA world hypothesis was so compelling was that RNA can catalyze its own synthesis. You don't need, you know, RNA can get by without lots of other proteins involved. Mm-hmm. And so it was a quick and easy way to think about how, you know, replicating molecules can come about. I would think that's going to be one of the most exciting areas of research, probably in the next decade or so. You know, because people are really doing all kinds of brilliant experiments looking at the conditions upon which life likely emerged and trying to simulate those and to see what extent you can get nucleotides, what extent you can get self-replicating molecules by, you know, simulating those conditions. But at the same time, you have that research program. You have us understanding the microbial world with ever-increasing precision because of sequencing technology and computational technology. What's gone hand in hand are sort of two technological revolutions. One is our ability to sequence genomes, but the other is to make sense of those genomes computationally. Mm-hmm. You know, so you put all that power together, you know, all of a sudden that whole microbial world becomes open to us. You know, just think about it. You know, the revolution in biology in the last 5 years of what we call the microbiome. Well, that's just the tip of the iceberg, because the evolutionary iceberg means we're going to be understanding a whole lot more of diversity. So my answer to Stella's question, big Stella's question, is smart Stella's question, is that, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, come back in 5 to 10 years, I think that's where we're going to have most of some very basic insights that'll change the way we see things. Because what suggests that to me is there are a bunch of studies out there looking at the oldest crystals on Earth, mm-hmm. suggesting that water and the conditions for life got going very early in the history of our planet, you know, over 4 billion years ago. So it may be the situation where life had many starts, you know, and over you know, hundreds of millions of years, and then one set of lineages took off. And so, you know, there's going to be I think that's one area of research we're going to see a lot of work and a lot of discovery over the years.
It's fascinating, and I think it gives us a lot of insights too, the more that we study our own origins, into these big picture questions about life elsewhere in the universe. I mean, we found many candidate areas where the conditions do seem to be right, and even not the classical Goldilocks conditions. You know, Europa is a very good example of a place where there absolutely could be life.
Think of Enceladus, and, you know, another moon
of Saturn,
you know, which has the oceans over. Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, it's an exciting time because we're now able to send probes out there at the same time we understand our own microbial world, you know, and chemical world.
And we may be looking at one of those examples of what we here would call a false start, just because, again, with hubris, it doesn't really lead to us. But capturing evolution in its earliest phases, how fascinating.
Well, let me give you a little perspective, though.
Oh, sure.
If, you know, let's say aliens were to visit the Earth in 1 billion years, there's a good chance we'll be called a false start, right?
You know, yeah.
The story is not entirely written on us yet. And so, I mean, from the cosmic perspective. So we have every chance of being a false start, a dead end, or whatever you want to call it. We're just defining ourselves versus the present, and the future is yet to be written.
Right, because we are the ones making that definition.
Exactly.
You know, it's kind of built in. But it is one of those things that I think so fascinated me when I was, you know, young and starting off in my scientific studies. And I remember learning in an intro to biology class about how the earliest eukaryotes, right, the earliest multicellular organisms first evolved, and how special mitochondria and how special chloroplasts are within the cell because of their interesting symbiotic relationship with these earlier bacterial organisms. It seems like there are all these beautiful stories of evolution and beautiful discoveries that we've made about this branching tree of life that I worry that the public doesn't get to hear those stories.
No, they don't. And, you know, you think about the world you're talking about, right, the eukaryotic world, or think about the microbial world. I mean, mm-hmm. they're just trading genes left and right, right? They're swapping from one species to the next. There's symbiosis where organelles come together in various creatures to make a new form of life. I mean, there's all this swapping going on, and there's all there's an arms race too. You know, some creatures are trying to fight the swapping, evolving mechanisms to stop that. Mm-hmm. That's how the CRISPR-Cas system came about, as a bacterial sort of immune system. And so, you know, the creatures are evolving in all kinds of ways, inventing new mechanisms, but they're also trading information in ways we could barely have imagined 2 decades ago. You know, and so, you know, it's funny, that story is not really known very well. Mm-hmm. And it is so powerful. It's powerful in kinds of giving us technologies to manipulate the genomes, but also in understanding how life came about and diversified.
Yeah, it's like we really do have to understand the simplest mechanisms first. We have to be able to, in our kind of forensic discoveries of our own lineages, we have to be able to draw out a simple equation and Occam's razor everything first before we can really start to grasp how complicated and nuanced it becomes. And it seems like every couple of weeks, especially because of CRISPR-Cas9, we're seeing so much incredible research happening in that field. Every day you can read almost a new study about an interesting kind of change, an interesting new technology that's coming out of that. It's just, what a great time to be alive, to be reading scientific research. There's so much amazing stuff happening
Oh,
right
yeah.
now.
And Cas9 is like a research program in and itself, a whole discipline, mm-hmm. right? There's just so much going on technologically with that. But keep in mind, Cas9 is just one of many different Cases that exist in the microbial world. You know, that's just the one that was initially discovered. So there are others out there, you know, some of them have yet to be discovered, which is amazing, which will also have technological power to them, or may have power in explaining a lot of our world. So that's kind of the world we live in right now, you know.
And it's so great because I love this idea that scientists in labs are trying to answer questions. That's really where everything comes from. I want to understand this better. I want to be able to solve this problem better. I want to answer this question. And in order to do that, oftentimes, the technologies don't exist to be able to answer the question. So first, I have to make the technology work. Then I can harness the technology. Then I can start answering the question. So a lot of times we see, you know, these aren't just programs that exist elsewhere. These aren't just machines that you can buy online. They become that eventually, but somebody has to work diligently to make these kinds of manipulation techniques rigid, to make them reliable. And oftentimes we do start with the ones that are a little easier to manipulate.
Yeah, and also cheaper.
And cheaper, that's huge, because there's some things we could be doing, we just can't afford to.
Exactly, you know, that much of us, particularly with the funding in science. Yeah, it's funny, I live in two worlds, right? I live in a world where one research program is, we go up and look at rocks and crack them with a hammer.
Yeah.
Right? And the other is, you know, doing CRISPR-Cas or cell lineage analysis or, you know, doing transgenic animals and so forth. So it's funny living in those two different worlds. But interesting, though, the one research program that involves cracking rocks with a hammer, that too is getting, you know, is influenced by technology as well, obviously with CT scanning, because you can scan inside rocks now, or drone technology in the field, and you name it.
And how common is it now that when you do find a really important fossil, that a small piece of the actual matter, the fossil matter, will be kind of ground off to be analyzed at a micro level?
A lot. I mean, so like, yeah. It only depends if you have lots of specimens, you know. So with mm-hmm. Tiktaalik, we have lots of specimens. You know, we'd have to be careful about which ones we want to analyze. But we could do that. I mean, it's not a big deal. The thing that really helps a ton is, you know, we have a CT scanner downstairs that's just made for fossils. So basically, we scanned the entire Tiktaalik collection, you know, and we now have a digital library of every single bone that was collected. And we can do 3D models of them. We can do measurements on them. We can make a 3D museum that other, digital museum that other people can utilize in their own research. You know, so it changes how you do research. It changes how you disseminate research results, you know, that kind of technology, which is really exciting. So that when you have that, you can then, you're a little more free to do some sort of small, targeted destructive sampling, you know, if you have that record,
yeah.
You know, it makes it a little easier.
It's interesting. I shared probably a few months ago on social media a link to a repository that does exist that has all of these great fossils that it kind of a public domain repository where anybody can go, they can download the map to their fossil and they can 3D print it at home.
Right, exactly.
How cool is that? And also think about all of the things, guys, that you can see inside that you can't see from the outside. There was recently an exhibit at the Natural History Museum that traveled from the Field Museum, your home museum, and it was all about mummies. There was a Peruvian side and an Egyptian side, and every single mummy that was on display had the CT data next to it, because of course we don't want to unwrap them. Of course we don't want to disturb them, but they could see, you know, this is a mother buried with two babies. Look at, there was a cat buried in there. They were able to bring their favorite toys with them. I mean, it was so incredible to see what was inside of those delicate wrappings.
Yeah, and it also gives, you know, think about the educational benefit. Just taking another example, you know, we're going to put a lot of Tiktaalik online for teachers to print out bones. Mm-hmm. You know, they can, you could print it out. You could print out any size, any color, you know, but kids can, you know, interact with the physical object in a way they can't interact now. So it gives a, you know, it gives a means of seeing things in new ways, of being able to measure things in new ways, display them in new ways, but also disseminating the scientific information in new ways.
Yeah, and just looking at it from different angles, you know, being able to. I did a story recently on VR technology, and I think it's called surgical theater. A lot of surgeons are now using VR, where they'll take all of these different imaging, like overlays of different types of imaging, and composite them together, especially neurosurgeons. That's who I was visiting. And they can then, before they do a surgery, put on the headset and basically, quote unquote, fly around inside of their patient's brain. They can see the tumor from a side where it's obscured. They can go through the tumor and they can see all of the vasculature running through it, so that when they actually go to operate, they have a perspective on this tumor that they've never had before. And I can only imagine that being able to see fossils in a CT scanner shows you things you never could have seen with your eyes.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's and just take drone technology or take imaging technology like remote sensing from satellites. Mm-hmm. You know, the last time we went into the Arctic, we actually picked our campsite, you know, from the air, you know, from satellite photos. Whereas before, I used to have to hang out of a helicopter, you know, spending $3,000 an hour. You know, yeah. I mean, it's amazing.
Wow. So one thing that I have to ask, being about halfway through the episode, because I would love to, you know, watch your inner fish, read your inner fish. Everybody listening, if you haven't had a chance, there's just, it's fascinating. It's the most incredible popular science program, presented obviously by Dr. Shubin through PBS. I think it was a 3-part special, right?
Yes.
Yes. And of course, the book is a book. Check it out. You can learn so much of this background. But I would love to start talking about where you are now, what the future holds, and what some of your research is. So to kick that off, here's the last question that Stella submitted for this episode. Are you still focused on Tiktaalik, or are you looking for more transitional species, like between cartilaginous and bony animals, for example? And if so, where do you think they're hiding? Because, of course, the incredible story here is that you didn't just stumble upon Tiktaalik. You, based on all of the research and investigative and forensic work that you had done, you said this species should exist, and I think it should exist in this region. Let's go see if we can find it.
Yeah, exactly. We used the paleontological sort of toolkit, which was essentially, if you want to find something new and important, you have to have rocks of the right age to answer whatever question interests you, rocks mm-hmm. of the right type to hold the fossils, and rocks that are exposed to the surface. I mean, it's that simple, you know, in principle, but in execution, it's really hard, trust me. So using that toolkit, we found Tiktaalik, but, you know, the questions that I'm interested in actually go deeper. I'm interested in the origin of our branch of the tree of life even deeper still. You know, how did skeletons come about? How did hard parts come about? How did the basic vertebrate body plan come about, you know, in early cartilaginous fish and early bony fish, and even deeper still into, you know, jawless fish? You know, we have a lot of fossil evidence, but we can use a ton more. And we're focusing on rocks of the right age, of the right type, exposed to the surface, you know, again, the paleontological toolkit, and mm-hmm. rocks that are significantly older than the ones that held Tiktaalik. Now, we're still working on Tiktaalik. We have, I have a graduate student or two working on some of this, the biomechanics of how it fed and how it moved about and so forth. But in terms of field discovery, we've moved deeper in time. And the kinds of places that would hold those kinds of fossils are, again, in the Arctic, also in the Antarctic, in parts of Eastern Europe, and parts of actually the American West. Parts of the Canadian West, the mountainous Canadian West. So those are all the sorts of things we're considering for future field work. In my laboratory, remember, I have sort of a split brain research program. We have a field research program where we run expeditions. But to answer the same questions, we're also using genetic and genomic technology. And so what we're trying to do in the laboratory is looking at fish and at limbed animals. We're really sort of asking the question of how do the genes that, you know, that are involved in the formation of, you know, key features in us, parts of our skeleton, parts of our nervous system, our guts and so forth, you know, how they come about in fish. And so we're deploying a lot of these new technologies, some of which we already talked about, to really understand, you know, genomically how we have evolved. And it's really exciting, you know, because what's exciting about it is you can ask the same question about evolution and deploy all these different tools. We can go out, you know, to the Arctic and collect fossils. We can work in the laboratory and work, you know, on living fish to really understand how the genome, along with the proteins within the egg, serve to build bodies. You know, so we can deploy these different approaches to probe some very fundamental questions. You know, how did skeletons come about? How did teeth come about? You know, how did the pharyngeal arches, which gave rise to so much of the head skeleton, how did they come about? You know, so these are all big questions. You know, if you were to take an anatomy class, they'd be some of the biggest ones you'd learn. And, you know, that's kind of where we're off now. You know, I'm sort of a rolling stone in terms of research. So, you know, I'm always looking for new projects. And so even when we were working on Tiktaalik, I was always trying to think of other things. I just had to go back and collect a lot of Tiktaaliks. But even while we were doing that, I was just planning for our next expeditions. I would sort of drive my colleagues crazy because because we'd be sitting in there removing Tiktaalik. I'm like, you know, we should probably think about X, Y, and Z. And they're like, we just shut up. We're removing the Tiktaaliks.
And what about your grad students? They're like, no, I am finishing this project. Yeah, exactly. I am not switching gears.
You're right, exactly. Yeah, they're the conservative ones.
So, you know, we think about being out in the field, like you mentioned, and literally being out there with hammers and with brushes and trying to collect these fossils and putting them in plaster and bringing them back to the lab or to the museum. But when we talk about what you're doing in the lab, you know, with this genomic research, I think it becomes a little more of a black box to a lot of people who don't have a background in this field. Can you give us a little bit of insight into some of the ways that you try to answer questions in the lab?
Yeah. So for instance, if we look at fins, we can look at how fins develop. How does the cartilage form? How do the bones form? How does the pattern form? And what we can do then is begin to probe it at a molecular level. We can ask the question, you know, what genes are turned on and off during the formation of the pattern of a fin? Then when we do that, we can compare those that battery of genes to the battery of genes that are turned on and off at different stages in the development of a limb. And then once we categorize what's the same and what's different, then we can start to look at things a little more in depth. We can begin to ask, what are the elements of the genome that control those patterns of activity of the genes? You know, to turn them on and off, the switches that are behind this, and how do they interact with one another, and how have they evolved? Then we can look at the chromosome. We can ask the question, how do chromosomes open and close as, you know, as genes are turned on and off? Then we can begin to manipulate the development. We can begin to add proteins or actually turn off genes or turn them on in different places to ask, you know, how those genes actually work. How does the function evolve? You know, so that's sort of the research program, and it's so amazingly powerful because you can begin with an anatomical question, you know, how have certain structures evolved, how in a fin or in a limb. Then you can take it apart. Then you can start to look at it in the embryo. Then you can look at it genetically, and then you can look at it in terms of what controls the genes. And then you can begin to compare one species to another to ask it a very fundamental way, you know, what are the genetic differences between species and what do they mean? What makes creatures similar and what makes them different? Those are the big questions, right? And we now have the power to do that. And so it's just one step after another. We begin by looking at development in the embryo, how it goes from embryo to adult, and the patterns, and then we begin to take a peek at it in terms of molecular biology.
And what are some of the key organisms that you use in the lab? Do you mostly focus on zebrafish?
Yeah, well, zebrafish is a workhorse. You kind of need a workhorse. You need a, it's a work fish, I guess I should say. it's sort of, it's easy to manipulate in the lab. There are a lot of reagents and tools that are widely available. There are a lot of protocols that our researchers have developed. So zebrafish is a fabulous organism in a lot of ways. But for the questions we do, we need to add other fish as well. So zebrafish have undergone a whole genome duplication, kind of like a lot of other fish have done. So we want to look at other fish that are sort of lower or deeper in the tree of life. So gar and sharks and skates and rays, things that are we share a much more ancient common ancestor with. So while the workhorse for our experiments may be zebrafish, we'll be, you know, doing some experiments in these other more exotic fish, if you will, these non-model fish. Because they're the ones that can really open up the questions for us in novel ways. So there are some fish, for instance, that are more closely related to limbed animals, like coelacanths and lungfish and gar. So we want to, you know, we access those in terms of their genomes and when we can get them, their embryos.
But it's interesting to think about doing non-model animal research. I mean, obviously, it's important. I always wondered how these model organisms became the models that they are.
Oh, typically,
it's just like enough people worked with them that they were like, yeah, let's just all stick with this guy.
Well, a community develops. And so what happens is, you know, somebody really smart or a group that's really smart comes together and says, you know, here's this creature has a potential model approach because it has lots of embryos. We can get its genome. We can see through the, you know, the embryo. We can do all kinds of experiments with it. So somebody demonstrates that, oh yeah, this thing would be great for a lot of reasons. Then it develops a community around it, and that community gets funded and they share resources, and one thing leads to another. They have students and postdocs and on and on and on. But what's interesting now though, is almost any critter can become a model organism. That is, if you have a genome available, let's say the genome's been sequenced, and you can get access to embryos, you know, with CRISPR-Cas, it's not expensive to do. With these other genomic technologies, some of them are not overly expensive. You can get sort of model system level biology on non-model exotic organisms like gars and sharks and others. And that's what you're seeing happening. Usually the limiting step is whether you have a genome available or not, whether it's been sequenced or if it's or sequenced at a good enough resolution to do, you know, research.
Sure. And it seems like some of these different reagents and tools that have been specifically kind of developed over many years for these organisms makes it cheaper and easier.
Yeah. So, you know, typically what we'll do is we'll start trying to, you know, we'll have a shark embryo in the lab and we'll like, okay, let's treat it like a zebrafish, you know, and we'll we'll use like the zebrafish protocols and, you know, that'll work about 60% of the time. And then you tweak it from there. So we've gotten it working for sharks and skates. And other critters like that, yeah. And that's the amazing thing about the technology. It's sort of democratizing, you know. It can make anything a model organism in a way, and everything becomes cheaper, and lots of labs can do it.
It's fascinating. And this is, guys, why when you do look at, you know, if you're one of these people like me who has a feed reader and you follow all of the new science news and you're always looking at what's being published, it's like, why is every study either a mouse, a rat, a zebrafish, Arabidopsis, cotton, or Drosophila melanogaster, which is the fruit fly, or C. elegans, this worm, this nematode? It's you know, you always see the same organisms being used over and over. Well, this is why, but it is cool to see that they're starting to branch out. It's not because scientists just really are concerned about little C. elegans. It's because it's a good model for understanding a lot of other processes.
Yeah, sure. Well, C. elegans is great because we know where every cell ends up. You know,
it's so crazy.
It is crazy. And so, but also, you know, C. elegans is weird in a lot of ways, as is Drosophila, the fruit fly, as is a zebrafish, you know. So, you know, each model organism has its challenges, and that's why, you know, it's you do the experiments on a model organism, but, you know, oftentimes we're trying to understand the ultimate non-model organism, and that's human beings, you know. So sometimes we got to add other species into the mix.
So I have to ask, kind of from a personal perspective, you know, you are such an incredible science communicator. It's getting to be less rare, but it's still quite rare that you meet people who both are very committed and successful scientists who also are passionate about science communication, because it's not easy. It's not easy to wear both hats. It's not easy to do both things. It takes a lot of time and effort. You're sitting down with me for a full hour out of a day when I'm sure you have other things to do.
No, I have nothing else to do. Don't worry about it.
How much of that, though, do you think comes back to just being passionate about teaching? And do you still teach? And when you do teach, what is so important about teaching to you?
Yeah, let's start with that. So the teaching, yes, I'm teaching now. I teach a spring quarter course at the University of Chicago for first and second year non-majors in biology. There are about 40 of them. It's the human body in evolution. So basically it's urine or fish, only at a little higher level. Than the book. Yeah, so I'm teaching them your inner fish, and you know, it's 40 students, and I go through the lectures, and it's fun. I get questions from people who haven't thought about it before. It impacts, when you teach, A couple things go on. One, it forces you to look at your own material in a different way. And number two, if you're teaching to good students who are really thoughtful, they can challenge you in a way that's fun. Mm-hmm. They can come at it with a different perspective. And you learn as a writer and as a communicator when you see their perspective. You know, so I, as I teach, I think I become a better communicator, dare I say, when I can interact with students. And one of the advantages I had when I wrote Inner Fish is at the time, I was teaching human anatomy to medical students. I was teaching anatomy, comparative anatomy, to on and off, to undergraduate and the college students here at Chicago. And I was also at the Field Museum, you know, occasionally explaining stuff to kids and trustees. You know, so I was giving sometimes the same lecture to three different focus groups, you know. Mm-hmm. And, well, when you do that, it hones your message really, really well. Because you kind of learn what the universals that people are interested in are. And you kind of learn what people struggle with. You know, yeah. And so it gives you sort of a roadmap to how to think about it. The other thing I get, so like I do a fair amount of speaking to, you know, public groups, you know, larger groups, non-science and so forth. Mm-hmm. I invariably find that an elevating experience, always. And the reason for that is I get to interact with them after the talk and I get to see what they what resonated with them. I get to feel their energy to some extent, you know, their excitement, their enthusiasm. And when you do it right, you can feed off of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can be really a rush when you do it and it goes well. But it can be an intellectual rush as well, because you invariably get great questions that either help you see the science in a different way or sometimes help you see the science communication in a different way. You know, so I'm always learning, you know, and I'm always sort of correcting my message and tweaking things. And I'm usually doing it in response to the people I meet and talk to. And talk with, you know, so that's good. I have good times with it, and not to say it always goes great, but you know, the times I've been a clunker in scientific communication are the times when I've stumbled into jargon, you know, and I'm just like not sure. Thinking, you know, it's just kind of the rookie error, and because it's really the concepts, not the words, that matter. And as scientists, the words have a precision to us, and we mm-hmm. really focus on them. So the key thing is I have to take that hat off, you know, almost consciously when I'm writing and speaking to not ever use jargon.
Yeah, it's not easy. I mean, I think those are the two biggest mantras that I typically will use when I'm talking about science communication in a public setting is number one, as you just said, you have to know your audience. You know, it's totally different when you're talking to a group of graduate students than when you're talking to a group of school children or when you're talking to a group of policymakers. Like the number one thing that's so important is knowing your audience.
Oh, you bet.
And the number two thing is, as I always like to say, never underestimate the intelligence of your audience, but always underestimate their vocabulary. They don't speak the same language as you do.
That's right. And they may
but that doesn't mean you have to, quote, dumb down the message.
Exactly. No, you don't. And the other thing is you got to know your shit. You got to know your topic really well. Because the only way you're going to simplify it without jargon is to know it upside down, backwards, front, and center. So if you really know something, you can communicate it a lot more simply than if you don't. Trust me. And so the times I've struggled as a writer and as a communicator are times when I didn't understand something as well as I should have. You know, I would have written a chapter and I'm writing like the Inner Fish or something like that. And the chapter's not going great, or a section of the chapter is not going great. And I'm like kind of wondering, oh, I got writer's block. Oh, man. But it really invariably comes down to not writer's block. It comes down to that I wasn't really thinking about it right. I didn't have a full grasp of the science. And so usually then I would sit back and really reread things and bam, I'd find my way.
Mm-hmm. Do you struggle as somebody who is both an active scientist and a science communicator, do you struggle to stay in your lane, especially as an individual who works in kind of these hot button areas like paleontology, like evolution, like genetics, where there is a lot of pushback, where there's like a politicization, that's not a word, of a topic that is just a fundamentally scientific topic. Do you just try to shy away from it? Do you generally not comment? Or do you like to go there and talk about why it is important for the public to be educated about these things, to push back against those, I don't know, sometimes more religiously and less scientifically motivated arguments?
No, I charge right in, but I do so without looking over my shoulder. And, you know, here, look, take a look at it this way. I wrote a book, you know, during sort of wars between evolution and intelligent design. that basically told people they're a fish, okay? You know, and I didn't look over my shoulder when I did it. I didn't have a chapter saying, here's why evolution's right and creationism's wrong. I just said, here's the science, okay? This is what it is. And it, by the way, it's fun to do, and it has explanatory power and predictive power. This is what it is, and this is where it takes us. And these are some of the cool things we learned. That's how I dive into it, you know what I mean? So inner fish was kind of my strategy in a nutshell, really, to enter these oftentimes contentious discussions, but to do so, you know, with a narrative that's joyful, the narrative that's powerful, with a narrative that makes the argument without me really making the argument. You know what I mean? So that's kind of how I like to do things.
Sure. And I think that having this kind of unapologetic approach, just baseline, this is how it is. I don't have to argue anymore that this is not how it is. The burden of proof is on you out there if you're concerned with trying to disprove this research, because there's so much corroborating evidence now. That's one thing that I love so much about evolution as a process, evolution as a concept, is that just every day in every field, we see more and more corroboration, almost more than anything other than maybe some unifying theories in physics. It's almost hard to point to another process that's so well established.
Yeah, what's mind-blowing is, you know, Darwin came up with evolution in, you know, the 1850s, right? Mm-hmm. And he had no idea of all the corroborating evidence that was to come from technologies and ideas in biology that didn't even exist at his time. We didn't even know about genetics at the time.
Yeah, Mendel was like barely digging around in his pea plants, right. But he didn't even talk about it for, I think, what, like a decade?
Nor did we know genomics, you know, where some of the most powerful evidence of evolution. So, you know, whole lines of inquiry of evolution have opened up since Darwin, and, you know, have only been corroborating. And it's, he didn't even know about this stuff, and he came up with this theory. It's amazing, you know, really, it's incredible.
It's insane. We often don't think about that. And also the we see it kind of similarly today, especially in American culture. But how the political and kind of social mores of the time did not allow for this idea of evolution. And Darwin was really smart about it, right? Because he talked about the origin of species first, and he sort of left man out of it until a little bit later, because he personally struggled with that. He's like, it does seem like the only answer. That said, it turns a lot of what people believe to be true on its head. And I don't really want to rock the boat. I just want to do good naturalism.
Yeah, he didn't, you know, the origin of species was one long argument. But it wasn't, he didn't look over his shoulder too much, you know, that's what was his brilliance to it. It's just such a well-constructed argument. But, you know, he never said, well, here's why creationism doesn't exist. No, he made the argument for natural selection and common descent, you know, and
He knew there would be pushback.
Oh, boy,
but he had, and it was hard. It was a struggle for him. His wife was super religious. I think he had a crisis of faith himself. But it's like, what do you want to do? Like, this is where the evidence is pointing me. And as a good scientist and a good skeptic, how do I ignore evidence to try to retrofit back into some sort of mindset that just doesn't hold water anymore? And I think that that's so, you know, so fundamentally what it means to be a scientific thinker. And I think that that's why Darwin is such an inspiration to so many young people who are interested in getting into science, and now naturalism. Sorry to go off on a tangent, but I just did an episode last week with Leela Higgins, who is the manager of citizen science at the Natural History Museum of LA County. She studied entomology in school, but we have this massive following here in LA of basically amateur naturalists, people just like Darwin, who didn't have any scientific training, but who like to go out and look at the nature that exists around us, plant, animal, insect, insects are animals, but plant, vertebrates, invertebrates, all these different organisms, and try to understand them and try to share them. We now have platforms like iNaturalist, where you can, you know, look at somebody else's posts and you can help them identify the things that you see. Just such a cool thing that we're coming full circle to these early naturalist endeavors. And now you can be a Darwin-esque figure.
Yeah, and the thing that blows me away about Darwin is, you know, if he never published The Origin of Species, he still would have been considered a genius for his work on coral reefs, on barnacles, on climbing plants, facial expressions. I mean, he did so much. He was always, you know, thinking of unifying frameworks and testable predictions. And it's just a genius.
Oh, yeah. I think one of my favorite books about Darwin is The Reluctant Mr. Darwin by David Quammen. Mm-hmm. It's such a great narrative, and it really gives you some insights into Darwin as a person through his writings and through his correspondence and his stresses and his illnesses, and it really makes him human, which I appreciate. So I have to ask you another kind of interesting personal question. When I watched Your Inner Fish, it opens with you in the Gross Anatomy lab. You're sitting there and you have this human hand that's like semi-dissected, and you're like talking about some of the traits that we see in humans that you also see in these lobed fish. And it makes me wonder, you know, because this is what you did as a teacher historically and still do, is you look at these comparative anatomy features in a cadaver, an actual cadaver. Was there pushback from the producers? Was this something that you had to fight to be able to do, or did everybody embrace, sure, let's put, you know, a piece of a dead body in a PBS special?
No, we had a lot of discussion about that, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, that was, I should say, that was the test reel. So when we originally did Inner Fish, I was not going to host the show. And I sold the option for the book, and they were going to do it, maybe have a narrator, you know, kind of that. Then it became clear that, well, it's kind of a personal story. Maybe it's good that I sort of play a larger role. So before we did that, we did a test reel, and we did it in the anatomy lab. And it turns out that test reel made it into the show as the opening scene.
Cause that's so funny.
It was funny, yeah, because we just loved it. And because it was just so personal. And it began emotionally there, right? Because that's my emotional connection to the material. And so, we gave a lot of thought to that, actually, because, you know, there is a, you know, people probably would turned off the show at that. I'm sure there are some people who said, no, they can't take it, they're gone, or just didn't turn them off. But really, the show had to have integrity, because the show was, the idea of Inner Fish was born with that moment. You know what I mean? And I, in particular, felt that that if they're going to tell the story of Inner Fish, that understanding the hand in a human is really essential. And a graphic would have been okay, but that's not how the book was born. That's not how the idea was born. It was born in the anatomy lab. And that there's a power to it, seeing the human body, seeing the intricate structures, and seeing its reality. So we went back and forth on that a lot, and ultimately decided, no, we'll take the risk and we'll keep it in the show. And we haven't regretted doing it.
I think it's really powerful. I wouldn't be surprised if you got some feedback from people saying, you know, it was a little jarring, but it was very powerful for me to see that.
Yeah, you'll see, like, in the Amazon reviews, there's some people who said, you know, I almost turned the show off at that point. But it's a short, we kept it really short. That segment is, you know, it's maybe a 20, let's call it a minute. So we brought it down as much as possible, but we didn't tone it down. You know, we wanted you to see the real thing. That was a struggle. We had a couple other struggles like that in the show where we had discussions about, is this the right thing to do? But to PBS's great credit, to the producer's great credit, to the directing team's great credit, everybody, we were all on the same page ultimately on this.
And, you know, the show ended up winning the Emmy Award last year, the 2015 Emmy Award for Outstanding Graphic Design and Art Direction. And the book, of course, has won multiple awards. I'm looking at it right here. National Academies Book Award in 2009, Kavli Science Journalism Award in 2014, a Communication Award for Film, Radio, TV from the National Academies. Did you ever expect, as a scientist, who, you know, of course, obviously there are awards that are given in science too, and they're very important, and they're meaningful to an extent, you know, just like all of us have this like struggle with, yes, I'm very proud to have won this award, but at the same time, my research speaks for itself, and it's not about the awards. Did you ever expect to be breaking through the public and popular consciousness the way that you have?
No, there's no way I should have or had any right to. I mean, when I was writing Inner Fish, we were actually, at the time I was writing Inner Fish, we were writing the original papers for Tiktaalik. So I was doing the scientific writing as well as it took about a year and a half to do that, and to write the book, which took about a year. And I was doing both at the same time. You know, one was part of a team, the Tiktaalik Scientific Nature Papers, and the book obviously was me and my editor. Little did I know at the time just how much, you know, it would get out there. But I remember those as being heady times. I was just so excited, you know, but I had no way of predicting or knowing that it would get out into the popular sphere and the public sphere as much as it did, let alone win awards. You don't even think of that when you're working on something. You know, that's not the last thing you think of, actually.
Did you go? Did you get to go to the Emmys?
Oh, yeah. I walked the red
carpet.
Was it
super cool?
That was totally cool. Oh, my God. It was really great. And then, you know, we went to the bar afterwards, you know, with the Emmy, and just popped the Emmy down on the bar, and people would come up and like, hey, is that an Emmy? I'm like, yeah, no shit. That's what it is. Yeah. But think that. Yes, that was kind of fun. And it was, and you know, they, and doing the Colbert Report and all those fun things. It was, those were fun things to do. But what's nice about particularly Colbert and the and others, it gives you an entree to an audience you might not get otherwise. And,
completely.
You know, and it's such a privilege. So I remember when I do those things, particularly Colbert and a couple other things like that, you realize that you're now reaching out to a whole different crew, that you may be their only introduction for some of these people to these fields. And mm-hmm. so at first I felt the great weight of responsibility to do it right, to prepare appropriately. But then I felt fun, like, wow, this is a huge privilege, you know, now don't screw it up.
Yeah. And just being yourself and actually having fun makes it exactly. so much more effective, just being authentic, you know? And I see this a lot when I do, we do actually it'll be year two this year. Last year was our first time to do it. An annual, I can say that now, SciComm camp. So in Malibu, people can join us, and it's a weekend kind of camp where we talk about science communication and help individuals, whether they're at their home universities, whether they are independent freelance science communicators, PIOs, different people come together, graduate students who want to start communicating their work. And we talk a lot about what it means to communicate science and how to communicate science effectively. And a very common question that I'm asked is this question about breaking through, right? We always talk about being in an echo chamber, and we talk about having a built-in audience and preaching to the choir. You know, I love science. I'm talking about science. Is it only other science-minded people that want to listen? And the biggest question is always, how do I break through to this general audience who maybe isn't that interested in science? And it's a hard one to answer, but I really think it comes down to just make really compelling content.
Yeah, and I think the it's the content and it's the narrative, I think, is mm-hmm. the other piece. You know, what stories you're going to tell. Because you can think about, you know, a scientific explanation. You know, it's not just the facts, but it's what the narrative is that holds them together. The narrative of discovery, the narrative of learning, whatever that narrative is, the stories. Because that's how we humans sort of remember things. that's our framework mm-hmm. often. So for Inner Fish, for me in particular, and for other things as well, I'm always trying to think of what the narrative path is, you know. Because the narrative path will help me define what's relevant and what's not relevant often if I choose it right. Sometimes it can be the opposite, but you know, but if I choose it right, I'm in good shape. So that's.
And it's funny, you know, we were just talking about this idea that there is a type of hubris, and we're always talking about how do things lead to me? But the truth of the matter is, to be an effective storyteller, if you have a human component, it just resonates that much more. Telling stories that have that narrative, like you talked about, and especially those that speak to the human condition, really just translate to a large percentage of the population.
Oh, definitely. And when Inner Fish for me, or Universe, or whatever I write, is easiest, is when I think I'm your tour guide. Here we are in this wonderful museum, you know, and, you know, one of these things is my painting, actually. But, let me just show you. Let me show you how cool this is, you know, and I'm just taking you through my favorite places, you know. And when I have that mindset, usually the language and the narrative move a little bit more smoothly.
Well, Neil, I have to tell you, this has been so much fun. I am so grateful for the time that you've shared here on Talk Nerdy. I know the listeners are really grateful, and they've learned an awful lot. Before you go, is there anything else that you were hoping to be able to get to? Is there anything that you wanted to add?
Well, in an hour and a half, you covered a lot.
Yeah, so, I know. I'm like, how can we go anywhere? Yeah. No, and also that combined with the books that you've written, with the special that you did for PBS, there's so much that people can follow up on to be able to learn more. But again, why don't you let people know where they can, you know, where they can say hi on Twitter, where they can see some of your work, and just kind of point them in the right direction.
Yeah. So on Twitter, my Twitter feed is Neil Shubin, Twitter. And, you know, I usually post sciencey stuff about papers, sometimes just goofy stuff. Likewise, Facebook, my Facebook page is Neil Shubin. It's not hidden. And again, I post everything from travel experiences to the scientific paper of the week or some fun fact from my field of science. Have a lot of fun doing it.
Fun. All right. Well, Neil, thank you so much for taking the time. I learned so much, and I'm really honored. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.